You're listening to Around Comics, a special Before Watchmen episode, Minutemen number one. Thanks again for listening to Around Comics. Welcome to this special episode. This is basically going to be a weekly review of the Before Watchmen issues that come out. First let me introduce my guest. You've heard him on
the show.
You may know him.
It's Braxton Harrison.
Yeah, I guess you're not really a guest anymore. You're family.
Yeah, I'm kind of the cousin, at least the cousin, right?
From the South.
Southern cousin.
Sounds good. All right, so to let people know what this is going to be and what it's not going to be, basically I had the idea of doing a weekly review show of the Before Watchmen comics that come out. And the reason I wanted to do it is because I think there's going to be, and there already has been, so much talk about whether this should be made or, you know, what it means in comparison. Does it diminish the original Watchmen? Blah, 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 blah. You know, and to me, I'm so past that. I don't have the answer.
I think every position has been adequately expounded upon. So that's not what we're going to do.
Right. I just want to look at each issue as a comic book. Is it good? Is it bad? Did I like it? Did I not like it? We'll talk about how it may relate to the original 12 issues of Watchmen, but only in the sense of how does it, you know, correlate to the story?
Yeah.
Does it change things?
We gotta bring up the original Watchmen. Yeah.
But I want to stay away from any of the, you know, more passionate, you know, sort of arguments about the whole thing, because it doesn't matter anymore. It's published. It's out. It's on the stands. People are going to read it. So let's just talk about them on their own merits. So every week, hopefully. I think, I don't know exactly if that's the schedule, but I think every week we're going to see a different issue. There's like 7 miniseries. Some of them are 4 issues. Some of them are 6. Blah, blah, blah. I don't know. But however many they come out, how often, we'll try and do one a week. And so we begin with the Minutemen number one, by Darwin Cook, story and art by Darwin, colored by Phil Noto, lettered by Jared K. Fletcher, and a bunch of covers by different people.
I had no idea that Phil Noto colored this. That's kind of strange. I never thought of him as being a colorist.
Yeah, it is a little weird. When I read that, I was a little surprised, because you think of him as an artist.
And yeah.
So for him to come in and color this, I don't know. Maybe it was a special request from Darwin or something.
Yeah,
not sure. But
well, it's really good. Now that I know that, I'm looking through, paying attention to specifically the colors, and it looks really good.
Yeah, absolutely. Not to get too...
Especially the Hooded Justice segment. I really like the colors on that one.
Yeah. Well, let's not jump ahead yet to that.
Oh, my bad.
We'll get there. As the book opens up, we have sort of this very Watchmen-esque scene. And for those that may... one more thing. These episodes will have spoilers. We are going to go through the book. We're going to talk about specifically what happens in them. So if you haven't read it and you don't want to be spoiled, I wouldn't listen anymore. But we will be talking about the book, so there will be spoilers throughout the whole episode. That being said, the issue opens up, and it's Hollis Mason, the original Night Owl. who is finishing up his novel, Under the Hood, his sort of biography about his time as Night Owl and in the Minutemen. I can't speak today.
Minutemen.
And it's this very sort of quasi philosophical.
Perfect of the Watchmen mythos that we all know so well, of the symmetry between the panels and the. I mean, you immediately think, oh, okay.
This is Watchmen.
Yeah, this is Watchmen. And Darwin Cook is going to do the same thing that we've seen. And I'm completely okay with that. Okay, here we go.
Right. And as it goes, you know, it's this dramatic diatribe about your life and the beginning of your life to the end of your life, or how things change as you get older. And he's showing sequentially your viewpoint as a human being from a child to an adult, and then all of a sudden the world expands around you, and then something completely changes, and it's in this last panel on the first page, it's a representation of Dr. Manhattan, the blue with a symbol, little symbol in his head. Mm-hmm. And then you get to the next page, and he continues. And I did want to bring this, the first panel on the second page here. I don't understand what the hell this is. It's rain, and it looks like a foot in a manhole and puddles. But I really...
It's a bit confusing. I immediately assume it has something to do with the night that the comedian got tossed out the window, because there's something about that yellow. Did you say that was a footprint?
It looks like a foot to me, or
like some sort of a fisheye perspective or something.
Well, I'm glad I'm not the only one who has no idea what the hell.
Yeah,
because
I can't help you. I'm not sure what that is either. But I do get the sense that it has something to do with that. You know, that rainy night that the comedian.
Yeah, I do too. The raindrops specifically are very,
it's a New York sewer.
Yeah. But I don't understand it. It's a very confusing panel. But anyway, he goes on and talks, you know, it's basically him sort of trying to wrap up his life. And he gets to the near end of it, and he realizes, we pull back, and we realize he's writing this. And Hollis is like, this is terrible. This is not me. I'm not Tolstoy. I'm not some deep philosophical writer. I'm just going to have to be myself. And he's talking to his dog. He's sitting in his new apartment that he retired and moved into, and he's typing away at a desk.
All right, hang on just a second. When before we started recording, you had a very interesting observation about that, about the transition from this beginning narration to when we find out that it's
Hollis.
It's Hollis, and he's in the process of writing the famous Under the Hood book. So,
well,
it's almost like he's making an introduction to the audience. Like, okay, that's what you're used to. If you're going to sense or see any changes in the way the story is told, or, you know, I don't know.
Well, yeah, to
whatever.
Me, it was very smart by Darwin Cook
so.
To do
but
this.
But I didn't think of that.
He starts it out very Watchmen-esque, and it's very, you know, dramatic and deep and sort of, you know, introspective and everything you would expect from Watchmen. But then all of a sudden it's Hollis saying, listen, I just have to be me. I'm not Alan Moore. You know, it's basically Darwin Cook saying, I'm not Alan Moore. I'm not going to pretend to be Alan Moore because it'll just be bad. I'm just going to do what I'm good at. And that's exactly what I thought that opening was from Darwin, and I thought it was very smart of
very
him
smart.
Just saying, I know what you're going to expect, but that's not me. I'm going to keep doing what I'm good at doing. And he does. The rest of the book is very, very much a Darwin Cook book. You wouldn't, you know, he's not doing anything outside of what you would expect from Darwin.
We're on page 3 now.
Yes.
And did you notice the dog that he's petting? Do you see any similarities to the way he illustrated that dog?
To the Bombada?
To the dogs that the child murderer had in the original book. I don't know. There's just something about the way that dog is illustrated that, I mean, right when I saw it, I immediately was reminded of the way the dogs were illustrated, or, you know, it was a full face shot of the dog. Of course, I think it had an axe in its head or what have you, but
I'd have to go back and look.
I'm just wondering if Darwin Cook was purposely doing that.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how much these books contain nods to the original in those ways, like little hidden kind of things, or if we as the reader are just sort of making that.
Yeah, I didn't get up to go look at the look through my copy of The Watchmen to see if that is in fact what he was doing, and I wonder, you know, because there's going to be different writers, artists on the different books that are going to come out. If maybe there's some overarching command from on high to throw in these things.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, you know, one of the first things I thought
of. Darwin Cook's take. I would, without getting too far off of what we're doing, I would like to think that there is like one vision instead of everyone kind of going too far.
Well, Darwin is supposed to be like the overall kind of showrunner for it. I think that was the story. He was the first creator contacted, and they wanted him involved first.
Well, this is certainly his time period. I mean, this is.
Oh yeah, this is perfect. Right up his alley. Yeah. But you know, there are a couple of things in the first couple of pages, you know, that I thought of on the first. Or on the second page, when they go to the clock on Hollis's mantle, it's at like 8:05, which is, you know, hours before midnight. Which, you know, is that intentional? Yeah. Did he put, because this is so much, so many years before Watchmen, you know, and the clock obviously having to do, you know, counting down to midnight. So was that intentional? You know, it's quarter or it's. Like it looks like it's about 4 minutes after
eight
8:04. So is there anything there? But is that just me? You know. And then, you know, we're in the apartment now that Hollis is going to end up being killed in, and you know, one of the scenes on the next page is him looking at that gold statue that he had received for retirement, and that's, you know, the statue that he's beat to death with.
All right, so basically in Hollis's life, this is just after he's retired from being the night owl. And
correct.
Looks like he's moving into the garage that he's going to operate from.
Yeah, I believe so. That's what it looks like to me. That's
okay,
the apartment.
I didn't see that. But yeah, he's just going into business. He's retired from superheroing. And
he's writing. Now, he's finishing his book.
And he's looks like he's moving into this... this garage.
Right.
All right.
And then another thing I notice is he's smoking, and it's the same weird, like, ball cigarette things that we see in the original Watchmen. Which was,
well, I thought that it was a marshmallow, and he was
roasting it on the fire.
I thought he was roasting a marshmallow on an ashtray. I guess that's not the correct thing.
Yeah, it's the same, like, weird pipe. Glass ball pipe cigarette things.
Yeah.
That was in the original Watchmen. Which is interesting because if you look, well, we don't really see anything outside of his apartment. Everything else in this issue is from his memory. And the city is very much, move to the next page and he's talking to his agent. And you see New York. And there's no, like, you know, dirigibles floating through the air. And it looks relatively normal, except the building that's being built in, right there, I believe,
it's
is going
under construction.
Under construction, but I believe that's Ozymandias's tower that's being built.
Okay, I don't know. I don't know that, but, I mean, I guess the fact that something's, you know, the building, you know, construction always means that... you know,
foreshadowing.
Things are good. You're building new things and all that. So this isn't the time of decay. This is the time of somewhat prosperity.
And I thought there was a couple of other things Darwin did in here to set the time frame. Some of it being language. I was intrigued by his agent calling him a boyshik.
You know what? I have never heard the term before.
Oh, really?
And certainly never heard seen it, you know, spelled. So I had no idea what I read it as boychik, which, you know, in the South, that's probably a good insult to sling at somebody, you know, around here.
Right.
Boychik, huh? What does that mean?
Boychik or boyshik, it's a Jewish term, and it's sort of like you know, like my son, or, you know, like a mijo, you know, is in Spanish, but it's like, I believe it's Yiddish, and it's just like a, you know, buddy, you know, you're calling somebody, like kid or something like that, you know,
okay.
It's a term of endearment. But it's a very sort of 50s, you know, it's an older term.
Boyo.
Boyo.
Yeah, you know, I don't know, another 50s term. Busta.
Yeah.
Boyo, Busta, Boyshik.
Yeah, that kind of thing. But I thought that was an interesting usage, because I've seen it before in comics, even. If you go back to, like, Golden Age, Silver Age stuff, you'll see it occasionally.
Okay.
So he's talking to his agent, and, you know, he's talking about, you know, he loved the book. But, you know, are you crazy for writing all this stuff about the Minutemen? And Hollis is like, hey, it's, you know, it's all true. I'm not going to make anything up, but it's real stuff. And then he sort of starts to reminisce in his own head about his life as Night Owl. And then we are introduced to all the Minutemen. He basically goes, and it starts with the photograph, the very famous photograph of the Minutemen, you know.
Anything to say real quickly about Darwin Cook? I mean, I guess it's pretty established. You know, we know what his art looks like on everything he does. I don't think he changed his style or anything for this book. It's the same as it always is. I mean, what do you are you? Are you good with it and everything?
Yeah, I mean, other than that one panel that I couldn't understand what it was, so far it's, you know, I love Darwin Cook's art.
He sound, and, you know, his he can tell a story with his images and everything, but it's not my favorite, one of my more favorite styles of art. I like, you know, I guess maybe a scratchier, looser art, but I can definitely see him telling this particular
tale.
Period. Yeah, this particular tale. So
he definitely, I mean, it fits to this sort of genre or era. Absolute Frontier. New Frontier is one of my favorite comics ever, and I love Darwin's work. I'm a huge, huge fan of his stuff. So,
well, it goes into the first intro, and we see the first intro of one of the Minutemen, and he tells us about Hooded Justice.
Yes,
and the year is 1939. He's now the narrator, and we're taken back to, I guess, one of the exploits of the Hooded Justice. I don't know what city this is. I guess it's New York. But this is, and I mentioned it earlier, of all of the book, I like the colors here because it, other than the splashes of course, red, all of the colors marry. They almost look like the same color with just a slight, you know, difference.
Yeah, very muted. It's
you
know, grayish blue tones, and then you have him. He's Red and the violence of him. Yeah, we see basically it's three pages introducing him, and it's from Hollis's perspective because he was a beat cop when two guys.
Right. I guess it was robbers? New York then. So
yeah, it must have been. Two guys robbed a federal bank, or four men robbed a federal bank and ran off. Two of them, I think, were caught or killed, and then he chased two more of them into some sort of factory, very reminiscent of, like, the Batman and Joker. Yeah,
of the Tim Burton's Batman.
Yeah, that's what I kind of got from that building, at least. They're in, you know, sort of some sort of industrial warehouse factory, and they're running around in the dark. The cops are all outside. They got the place surrounded. They're inside, and so is Hood of Justice, and he goes in there, and there's this great, the second page of the sequence is a sequence of one of the guys gets nabbed sort of off camera by Hood of Justice, you're assuming.
Yeah.
And Hollis is describing how for like a full minute, everyone on the street heard this guy basically screaming and crying and desperate, you know, pleas of help and pain. And you're assuming it's Hooded Justice, you know, torturing.
Doing whatever he's doing to him.
Yeah, doing whatever he's doing. And meanwhile, you're watching the other thug or robber inside the place slowly just completely lose it as he listens to this. And he's just
actually standing in a strange puddle. I don't know what that is, Sal. What does that represent?
I would think that's his fear leaking out of him. I think that's
fear
his
leaking
courage.
Down his
It's his
hand.
Courage leaking down his leg, yeah. But I thought this was interesting because it really did play to the idea that the Hood of Justice enjoys delivering pain to his victims. Maybe even on a sexual level, you know,
because
you have the very famous sequence in Watchmen.
It's always left to a question in the and I say really like that because now that you say it, I kind of see that too, because I recalled the his story in the original the Watchmen. And it is kind of ambiguous as to if he's, you know, some sort of a
sadist, if he's, you know, gets some sort of sexual gratification from doing this, as well as, you know, being a vigilante. I mean, that's what the comedian brought that up when Hood of Justice stops him from raping Sally. He's, you know, beating the crap out of him and
he Blake makes veiled accusation.
But if you sit here and think about it, it's like, you know, a vigilante going and stopping crime is one thing, but to sit there and, you know, make someone scream in pain for a minute would
That's a bit excessive.
It's a little. So what?
Something's going on there.
Exactly. That's what I got. You know, it's like, okay, so they're playing that up that, hey, maybe he was, you know, getting off on it as well. So, then we see, you know, the second.
Oh, we're not going to talk about what we think he was doing
or what he was doing.
That's a bit beyond the scope of.
Well, I mean, I don't, you know.
I'm just joking. I don't want to talk about what I think he was doing to him.
I don't. Leave that to the imagination.
Let's leave that to the imagination.
And
next we have Sally Jupiter.
Yes. Then we have. Oh well, I did want to, one last thing. It was interesting that even Hollis, you know, viewed Hood of Justice as terrifying. You know, like even he saw him that way. So, just sort of interesting little note. Next up, Sally, and I really liked this sequence too. I really liked how they pushed, he pushed the idea that, you know, Sally was just in it for the fame and money, and her exploits were more of a setup than real crime fighting. She, you know, she had this manager.
Was this all of her ex? I mean, are we led to believe that she was kind of a faux hero then? I guess this is leading up to the Minutemen's formation. So maybe after they formed, she had some real exploits, but
possibly. But you know, if you look at Watchmen, there's not a whole lot of information on what they did as the Minutemen. You know, it was really, to me, it sounded like it was a disaster and it didn't really accomplish much. So who knows? Sally may have never really done much actual crime fighting.
Well, I don't know. I thought that, and again, it probably wouldn't hurt if I read Watchmen
again,
you know, one time before all of this. But I was under the assumption that there was a prosperous golden period with the
Golden Age
Minutemen, and then you know all. The shit hit the fan.
It's possible. I don't. Yeah, I mean, I haven't read it in a while either, so I don't remember any mention of it. There may have been. In the, you know, beforehand, she was more of just a glamour pinup kind of thing. And then, as the Minutemen were formed, then maybe she did more real crime fighting. I guess we'll maybe find out. But, I mean, they set up here that she has this manager and they would go and find, like, a fledgling jewelry store that needed some attention and hire an actor to rob it as some sort of costume villain. And then Sally would come and save the day in front of, you know, journalists and newspapermen. And it would give, you know, some PR to her and PR to the jewelry store, and it was a win-win situation. And then he introduces the idea that even the cops are paid off and brought, you know, to ignore this fake crime fighting by her. And I love the sort of pudgy-faced Irish, you know, red-nosed, very typical, once again, of the era, Irish cop, chief of police. And then, you know, the language.
I've noticed the racial slurs that I guess are typical of the time.
Right.
And
definitely, you know, showing you, you know, this is an adult book, this is a mature book. We're going to, you know, but set in that time frame. I mean, you know, terms like kike and Mick bastard, that can, you know, I mean, those were very typical of the 50s, but they do, you know, to me at least, like reading them, they, you know, they jumped out at me. I was like, oh, okay. But so setting up, you know, Sally is very much this pinup girl more than a actual vigilante. Next up is Night Owl himself, and Hollis talking about how you know, which this was really interesting because he's walking the beat as a cop, and then there's like this car, very, you know, sort of typical Golden Age.
This is basically, I mean, this could have gone in an early Spider-Man. It could have gone in an early, you know, you pick it, whatever superhero book, Golden Age book of the superhero dressed in his secret identity, seeing some crime and then hopping into action.
Go ahead. I was going to say, it's interesting that he actually gets out of uniform as a police officer to put on the Night Owl costume to go stop this crime.
He could have done everything that
he did as a cop.
Yeah,
that's a really good cop. But it goes to show, like, he even says, like, when it came right down to it, I did it for the thrills, for the excitement of putting myself on the line. You know, like, he says that about himself, like, as he's taking his policeman's uniform off, and he's got the Night Owl costume.
That is not enough, you know?
Yeah, and then he has this great sequence of jumping into the armored car and fighting a bunch of guys, and the driver being shot in the head by his own guy, I thought was interesting because it portrays the violence of it, the reality of it, but still
not by his hands,
and the end of the sequence is him diving out of the car to save a girl and her son, a woman and her young son, from being crushed by the and it's a very, I thought it was very like Will Eisner spirit kind of ending. Yeah. You know, it was very cute, but when you sit there and think about it, it's like he kind of caused the armored car to go out of control and almost kill them in the first place. So
yeah, but all in all, I mean, he seems to be the most, and I guess that persists into The Watchmen. I'm sorry. Yeah, The Watchmen. That he's the, I guess, the most saintly of all of the characters. That
the most noble of them.
Yep. Yeah.
Yeah, and, like Watchmen, you know, none of these characters are perfect. They're flawed. They're all flawed characters that would, you know, it makes them interesting. But I just, you know, the idea that he's aware how crazy it was and is able to admit the fact that, you know, he was doing it for the excitement, shows you his flaws. Next up we have a pretty short sequence with Edward Blake, the comedian. It starts off with him in a very seedy bar down by the docks. He's basically beat the hell out of everybody in the place other than the bartender.
Yeah, and he's 16 years old.
Yeah, I thought that was interesting that they really made a point of you know, explaining he's 16 at this time. And as the sequence goes on, this was another weird... The first page of this, the bottom four panels, is basically him eating an egg. It's like a close-up of him eating a...
pickled egg, man.
Pickled egg.
Popular in the South.
No, but it just... Didn't it seem weird to you? Like, what's the point of that?
Well, I guess he's being somewhat... And he's intimidating the barkeep here. At least that's how I read it. It's just, you know, some bizarre behavior. I've always thought that, you know, the comedian, and, you know, he goes into this weird laugh as he's eating the egg. I guess maybe he's keeping up with his persona, or he's just flat crazy, you know, batshit crazy. Because,
well, that was something that I was a little, you know, not crazy about, was as much as he was a despicable person in Watchmen, I never got the feeling that he was unstable or...
I never did either. Do you feel like their take, Darwin Cook, is making a big departure from how Edward Blake is portrayed in the original or in The Watchmen?
I think in this sequence, to me, it's setting him up as more of a, a lunatic. I mean, obviously...
Well, not only that, he goes right in and he just rips the guy off. He steals his money. I mean,
yeah, I mean, he goes in, he beats everybody up in the bar, and then he takes, you know, the money out of the cash register, which, you know, sets up the ambiguity of him. Is, you know, is he heroic? Is he as much a thug as the guys that he's taking out? I kind of get that, but even that seemed as a, you know... I never got Edward Blake...
As just being a pure thug.
Right. I mean,
I
obviously...
I never did either. I thought that, you know, he did do his job. You know, he was a hero. And that, you know, as he grew older, he engaged in... Well, I guess he tried to rape midway in his life. But, you know, I thought that he... I mean, him as just a solid, you know, criminal.
Yeah, as I mean, psychopath.
Yeah.
Which... Okay, people may, you know, take me to task for saying, okay, he's a rapist, you know, attempted rapist, and not a nice guy, and you know, I mean, and a murderer. He's murdered. So I guess certainly sociopath, you know, but this seems like a different psychosis than what he was portrayed. I always thought he was more just such a. I mean, even his character, the comedian of sort of laughing at the joke that is life. I thought that was more, you know, he's more of a anarchist than.
Yeah. And not so much the fact that he was a true psychopath doing violence to innocents.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, even though when you think about it, it's like he tried to rape Sally Jupiter. He shot and killed a pregnant woman that he had, you know, gotten a woman pregnant and murders her in Vietnam. You know, he had no problem beating the crap out of just about anybody, whether they were. So I guess, yeah, I guess I just, I got a different
not a departure.
Yeah. I got a different feeling from him in Watchmen than this sort of 16-year-old, you know, complete psychopath. That just seems different to me, but I guess we'll just have to see where that goes. But I still think the whole egg eating sequence, four panels for eating an egg, is just weird. And I don't think it worked. I think it was just strange. Moving on to Byron Lewis,
this is the Mothman, right?
The Mothman. And this is probably my favorite sort of character introduction in the book.
It goes right into, I guess, why he went crazy.
Right. And then, yeah, if those that don't remember, Mothman.
I didn't understand, though, the first couple of panels of the description of him. I mean, what are they saying? Did he do something to himself?
Well, basically, they, you know, think about it this way. His power was he had a suit that allowed him to fly. And think about it, in the 1950s, if you're an experimental pilot with the most dangerous plane to ever exist, and every time
that was always the description of the most dangerous occupation was being a test pilot. So,
yeah, and so think, you know, think of the stress that this guy is under every time he puts the suit on. He doesn't know if he's going to walk away from it, and he's already. You know, by the time this story happens, he's already had accidents testing it out, trying to develop the suit. So he's in pain all the time. And he talks about how he's addicted to liniment and
aspirin pills.
Aspirin and, yeah, for the pain, which eventually led to morphine addiction, which, you know, was also part of his being institutionalized. Later on. But I just love that idea of like a different perspective on this guy of going, because all we knew of him was he went crazy. You know?
Well, and even with all of this introduction to him, we still don't know a whole lot about the guy. He doesn't engage anyone in a conversation. It's just him.
Right. It's just Hollis's ideas. Yeah. It's Hollis's thoughts on him. But I just love the idea that, okay, this guy was risking his life for this dream, you know, of being a flying crime fighter. And that's what led to his insanity, which I just love that sequence. I love this little thing that Darwin put together about this character that really was, you know, almost just a throw-in of like, oh, there was a Minuteman that lost his mind.
Yeah.
But now we see like,
this is a setup.
Yeah. The next one is Dollar Bill.
And he only gets a page.
He gets a page, and it's, you know, he's working for the National Bank Company. He's sort of their
commercial, kind of like Sally Jupiter.
Yeah. Like, but even more, you know, there's no pretense. He's their mascot for the bank, and then becomes a Minuteman and becomes a hero. So I guess we'll see you know.
The next one is actually, this is, I like the depiction of, is it the silhouette?
Yes.
Never, I don't see where it said her name, but this is my favorite depiction. And actually, I would probably like to see a whole comic devoted to this sort of character engaged in these really dark noir tales or what have you.
Running around Chinatown, yeah, hunting and down.
I like the way she's illustrated or depicted, I should say. Her costume is really cool.
Yeah, I mean, this is a perfect Darwyn Cook character. I mean, this is, you know, the spirit or, you know, something like that. The 50s Chinatown.
I like the colors on this one as well.
Yes, very nice. Yeah, it's Ursula, the silhouette, and it's Hollis sort of describing her as the most noble of the Minutemen. Her history as a victim of Nazi Europe in World War II led to her wanting to help others and stop stuff like child pornography rings and stuff like that. And she was, according to Hollis, she was, you know, the only one doing it simply for that, simply to help. There seemed to be no other motive.
So basically it's she and Hollis that are the most noble so far we've seen.
Well, but Hollis is a question. You know, Hollis is saying I wasn't that noble about it. I was doing it because I got, you know, I got off on it. I liked the thrills, the excitement. Where she was doing it purely to try and help, and sets her up in that way of saying, you know, it's such a shame what happened with her and how the newspapers and media kind of, you know, twisted it and turned her legacy into something that it shouldn't have been because of her sexuality, not what she was really doing.
Yes, and he does mention that she is a lesbian. You know, we already know that, but
right.
he knows it. I didn't know that they knew it back then, I guess.
Yeah, well, this is years after, so she would have, by the time he's talking about it, she'd be dead.
Oh, that's right. This is the time that he wrote the book.
Yeah, she'd already be gone, and that whole scandal came out already. So if he didn't know while they were... If you don't know, you don't know. But the sequence is her chasing someone down in Chinatown, a guy carrying a big rug, and eventually getting the rug away from him. And we find out there's a small boy that she
not
saves
good.
From.
Boys and rugs, not good.
Not good. Never good in Chinatown.
Nope.
And then there's the interesting, at the end of it, Hollis saying he guessed he was kind of in love with her, or loved her, which goes a long way to explain how screwed up he was, her being a lesbian, I guess.
Now that is a I don't think we've ever seen him say that in
no.
Watchmen.
No. Yeah, I don't think we ever saw him mention her in Watchmen, other than in the, well, even in his...
I think he was always after Sally, or he had some sort of a... He was pining away for her.
In some way.
Wasn't that the case?
I think he mentions something about her, but more in the sense of, like, she was, you know, everybody was attracted to her. Because, you know, she dressed in fucking fishnet stockings and a bustier.
That tends to have that effect, you know, fishnet stockings. All right, and the last one we have is Captain Metropolis, which...
Captain Metropolis.
Did you think that his headquarters that... he came by is kind of reminiscent of Ozymandias's headquarters in the Arctic. I don't know
a little bit.
If you know, going back to the images that may come up over and over again, or them trying to repeat images. This I thought that might, you know,
the
it's right there along the sea against a cliff, you know, and it just kind
of, yeah, and sort of the book the big blocky shape of it, tall.
I mean, what if you called yourself, I don't know, what, Super Sal, and you...
I do.
There was this, you know, you're looking for a headquarters, and this corporation, I don't know, Simple Suds Soap with a big double S.
Well, you can have SS? I don't think I want a giant headquarters in the 1950s with SS on it. I don't think that would...
That's true. As long as you don't ride it like a lightning bolt, you might be okay.
It'd be like, you know, KKK. That's my headquarters. Yeah,
that's
I'm...
not a good set of letters to use there.
But yeah, we find out that Nelson Gardner, or Captain Metropolis, was able to get a hold of this old
Canada Malting Company.
Yeah, construction of an enormous malting factory.
What is malting anyway, by the way?
I thought it was making like malt liquor, or at that time, is it like
it's not the chocolate candies?
Well, that's, you know, maybe, yeah, like chocolate malts. I don't know. I'm not sure. Malting. It sounds very like...
It sounds very 50s.
Yeah. Process, yeah. A malt, Canadian malting. It's Canadian malting. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think anyway, the combination of malt
CM on this, right, huge facade of this big building. So
it's Darwin just going, well, how do I come up with it? I need to CM, Canadian,
Canadian malting.
Canning. Yeah. No. Canadian malting. It sounds good. He gets this headquarters that was the huge factory, and we sort of get a little bit of a tour through it as Hollis is explaining Metropolis's
military background.
Military background, his money, how he prepared, how he had
He's
a vision.
Clearly the planner.
Yeah. And it ends, you know, you see like his, you see the watch, you know, sort of the communications room. Then you see like his different uniforms, you see maps and planning, and then, newspaper clippings from the different Minutemen. So he's, you know, gathering information, a gym with like a boxing ring and a heavy bag, then sort of, private quarters with, looks like, desk and statues. And then we're led into this big, you know, very 1950s pop art kind of bathroom, where he's sitting in a bathtub with his dictating a letter to his manservant, or his Alfred. And it's him putting an ad out to try and get the Minutemen together.
So we know that he started the Minutemen, which we knew. I think we already knew that. And he's another one I think I would like to see a comic on. I mean,
well,
he's going to be our Oliver Queen.
He's Batman. He's,
yeah, Bruce Wayne.
Yeah, very Bruce Wayne. And it's an interesting ending. Hollis says, like I said, Nelson and Larry were both smart enough to see how a group like the Minutemen could have its benefits. Some would say we've been paying for those benefits ever since.
End chapter one.
Yeah. And it's very ominous, you know, foreshadowing to bad things happening. Or
what do you think?
Well, we're not done. Then we have,
I didn't read that.
The Black Friday. Like the original Watchmen, you didn't read the Under the Hood or the Black Freighter. Did you read the Black Freighter stuff in the original Watchmen?
Yes, I did.
No, you didn't. You're lying.
I did. You know what, you're right. Like I didn't read it the fourth time. It's a lot of work involved
in
that.
There's like three or two pages.
There's only two pages.
What's
wrong with me? I should have read that.
There's two pages of a pirate story, The Curse of the Crimson Corsair, The Devil in the Deep, Part 1. This is by Len Wein and John Higgins, with letters by Sal Cipriano. And it's Tales of the it's reminiscent of Tales of the Black Freighter, a pirate comic in the story, I guess. It's different, though, because it's not in the story. It's just supplemental. And it's going to run in, looks like, maybe two pages in each of the individual before.
So
watching
in other words,
shows.
I need to start reading these two.
Well, it looks like, I mean, if they do two pages in each issue, that'd be like 70 pages of pirate story by the time it's done. So
can I read it at the end?
Ugh. You could just read it all. Well, it wasn't very. There wasn't much to it. It's basically.
Give me the synopsis. Tell me.
Synopsis is it's all foreshadowing. It's about a guy who joins his Majesty's King George's Royal Navy, and has this captain who his reputation is that he's stern but fair, but then he finds out he thinks he's overboard. You know, he's just sort of over the top because on the first night. Or first day that he's on ship, there's a midshipman that takes like an extra ration of rum during a night watch. And so they like toss him overboard, with like weights roped to him. And that's it. That's really the two pages. So nothing.
Okay. And it says, to be continued. Next week in Before Watchmen, the Silk Spectre. So that's what we're getting next week. We're getting
yes.
the Silk Spectre story.
Silk Spectre number one.
And you know, how's this going to work? So is Darwin Cook going to come back next month with his? We're getting them weekly, but
well, there's
monthly.
There's seven miniseries. Some of the series will be like. Four issues, some are six. I think the Minutemen one is six, so it'll be monthly.
It's monthly, yeah.
But yeah, basically you're going to get a series a month. So, yeah, Minutemen will be monthly, but Before Watchmen will be every week.
Gotcha.
There'll be an issue, I believe.
Who's going to be the creators on the Silk Spectre story?
I believe that is... Oh, gosh. Is that Amanda Connor?
Amanda Connor, and that's Darwin Cook again. So,
oh, okay.
At least there'll be some
consistency.
Yeah, because we're going to have the same writer. And as you said, do you think that Darwin Cook is possibly heading up the whole endeavor? So.
Yeah, don't quote me on that, but I thought I had heard that he's sort of, you know, overseeing the whole thing.
Well, it would be a very wise decision if they had someone do that.
Yeah, I think so. Although,
well,
I liked it.
Aside from, again, Darwin's not my, and you know, that's almost blasphemous. But he's not. He's not one of my more favorite artists, just, I guess, because of the maybe animated look to things.
Right.
But it definitely reads well. I like the panel layouts. He's going for lots of panels on the page. Phil Noto did great on the colors. Didn't know he was a colorist. Looks like he is. Really solid.
Good yeah. Stuff. Overall, I was really happy with it. The only thing, you know, there was a couple of panels that we went over that I was a little confused by.
One of them being the Bob on the second page.
Yeah. And then, you know, this is a very sort of getting the band together. Issue. It's a setup issue. You know, it tells you each character involved.
Tells you where you're at in time.
Yeah. It was good. It wasn't really exciting. The beginning I really enjoyed, and then once it kind of jumps into each, you know, character story, they were good, and I liked the fact that we got a little more insight on each character, and I enjoyed it, but it, you know, as a whole, as an issue, not real exciting. Not, you know, now it's just like, okay, well, what's going to happen now? We got that behind us. Now what's going to happen? But as far as art, I mean, it, you know, it's Darwin Cook. So I'm not, there's nothing here other than those couple of panels. Everything else, it fits the tone of the story very well. He's perfect for that era of superhero stuff to me. I mean, I love him doing sort of golden age comics. But with a little seedier side to it.
Yeah, that's another thing. I mean, this is golden age, but you've got seediness and the ugly side of humanity being depicted.
Yeah.
I was hoping while you were talking just now, I was just pouring over that panel trying to at least
figure out what
I thought it was, but I I can't decipher it. I don't know what it is.
You have the black and brown stuff on the side that looks either like mud.
I thought we were in a whale, you know, but then I'm like, well, what's the manhole?
I'm wondering, like, are we on a in a hole? Are we in the manhole? And then it's reflecting. Is it
now, if you look at the manhole, wait a minute, rain's coming down.
Mm-hmm. Into a circle. Why a circle? I don't understand what is creating that circle of water.
Maybe next month this might be an image that he does something else with. Or, you know, maybe on Twitter or somebody will let us know.
Yeah, maybe. Hopefully. Maybe Darwin will. Darwin.
You dumbass. It's a refrigerator. You can't see?
That would probably be...
clear as day.
You dumb sons of bitches. But, yeah, I mean, you know, as a whole, this is a very, you know, beautiful comic. It's really well done. I think Darwin, you know, is one of the best talents in comics. And, you know, great choice to open this up. It's hard not to like this. And it's even harder not to want to read the next issue.
Yeah.
So,
yep, looking forward to the next one.
Yeah. As a, you know, as a comic book, as a story, I enjoyed it. I thought it was very well done. And yeah, looking forward to Minutemen number 2. And I'm also looking forward to Silk Spectre number 1, which will be interesting. Different. Amanda Connor, I think, is a really good choice. It
what
looks
else
like
has
it's,
she done?
Oh, gosh. God, why do you got to put me on the spot like
type
that?
Type this into this device.
Yeah, exactly. You could just fucking Google it yourself instead of making me. But it looks like that series is... she did Power Girl. She did that Power Girl.
Okay.
She's done more than that, but... it looks like it's going to be set in the 60s with Silk Spectre with... what's her real name? Sally's daughter.
Sally's daughter.
Sally's... God. Hang on, we really should have read Watchmen again.
Let me type that into this device and see what it said.
I think we should have read that. We might want to reread.
It's Laurie just...
Laurie.
Esnick.
Yeah. Something Polish.
Just Esnick.
So look, yeah, that I'm kind of looking forward to that. I mean, that's the thing about, you know, and not to get off from what we sort of said in the beginning of not wanting to get into the whole is this good, bad?
Yeah, you don't think we're going to hell for?
I don't think. No, I think. Well, not for this. but you know, I think if they're good stories, to me, that's all I care about. I can't fight for creator rights, you know, other than say, well, I think creators deserve what they get. You know what I mean? Like, there's no, you know, there are no inalienable rights as a comic book creator. You get what you agree to. And, you know, sometimes it works out well. Sometimes you get screwed. That's kind of life.
Yeah, I heard someone say, maybe I shouldn't get into it, but I thought about it. It was a good argument, I guess, that's when I heard it. But would the Watchmen exist had it not even been for the Charlton characters anyway?
Well, sure, you have that, and, you know, you have...
But look what we're doing. We're getting
right
into it.
It's so complex, convoluted, and not something
and
we're going to answer.
Yuzpechik.
Yuzpechik?
Yes.
Well, that's good to know. Sally, use Petch. All right. Well, so yeah, I mean, I liked it. You liked it. It was good. I don't think we can, you know, not if somebody could tell me what those couple of panels were about, I'd be happy. But yeah, it was good. So there you go. There's Before Watchmen, Minutemen number 1. And thanks for listening. We'll be back next week with Silk Spectre, number 1. That's it?
Goodbye.
Say goodbye.
Bye-bye.
thanks for the memory of sentimental verse, nothing in my purse, and chuckles when the preacher said, for better or for worse.